Nobody told her. Nobody told her that life is a house of cards. And everything's fine as long as there's no wind. Nobody told her that it would all be blown away. Her house, her children, her love, her money. Nobody told her that nothing much is expected of her. Therefore, she doesn't have to hope for much. Nobody told her that she's the one getting on that train, on that bus, climbing in that car. And where is this destination? Nobody told her that while doing time for prostitution, struggling to make enough money to feed her baby, nobody told her that her baby's brains would be splattered on the back seat of a car in the Tenderloin. Nobody told her. Nobody told her. Nobody told her. So how could she know?
That's a reading from the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women, created by Rodessa Jones. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Rodessa Jones is an actress, teacher, singer, and writer, and the founding director of the award-winning Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women, a performance workshop helping to bring about personal and social transformation for women behind bars. Rodessa Jones is visiting Madison to collaborate with UW Professor Patrick Sims, founder of the Theater for Cultural and Social Awareness, and with Erica Dickerson, founder of the For Colored Girls Project, a student-led group that will be offering free performances for the public of Rodessa Jones' play, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, running from December 8th through 11th at the Play Circle of the Memorial Union. All three of them join us today to explore performance art as a tool for encouraging transformation.
Rodessa, Erica, Patrick, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's an interesting concept. I don't know if it's been done before, but somehow it seems like a very logical thing to do in a way to bring theater, bring acting specifically to incarcerated people, and in this case, women. What is the chemistry? How does it work?
Jails are raft with drama, crises. Everybody's acting out all the time. And also, everybody is a master con artist. The language is amazing.
Which actors have to be, don't they?
Yes, exactly. They're all alchemists. And they're shift shifters. They can shift the shape in a minute. And I found that incredible. The piece I just read brought me to this place of realizing that how dire it was, though. This piece was entitled She, and it was my first encounter with the dark reality of being a woman caught up in systems. In this case, this was a young woman who was in jail for prostitution, had left her baby with her boyfriend. The boyfriend gets in an altercation on the way home from daycare with the child, who's simply standing in the back seat of the car, nursing her bottle, and these men get into a fight. Guns come out, and this little baby is killed. This woman's locked down. She hears about it. She appeals to me and the group and says, they've got to let me go home. And we're like, no, honey, you're in jail. And this is the other end of being in jail. But it was so hard for all of us, for the artists from the outside and the incarcerated women, because it was like, this is totally over the moon. But I was in it then. This was my first year working in the jails, and all of a sudden, this is the larger struggle. How do we catch women who are falling like this? You know, and they had to lock her down because she said, I'm getting out of here. And it was like they put her in solitary confinement.
Well, and your repetition of that, nobody told me,
yes,
you capture the confusion, the feeling that No one told her where she was going with her life or what it was going to be like. What led you to create this Medea project to begin with, and how long have you been doing it?
Oh, I've been doing it now. I'm going into 25, 26 years. I was hired by the California Arts Council to teach aerobics to incarcerated women back in the day. And all of it was fascinating. I was thinking, aerobics? You know, I'm not an aerobics teacher. I'm a physical theater specialist. But at that time, I thought, I'll go. I'll do it. And they said, oh, by the way, you're replacing the belly dancer. You know? And so I was like, I'm in. And I started out attempting to be a gym teacher. Because the women were, because of diet, because of psychological placement, because of their own inertia and their depression, they were getting so fat. And the diet in jails is like powdered milk, sugar, powdered eggs, sugar. Sugar is a constant. And so they wanted somebody to come in and get the women moving. And I went in. And I realized something else was needed. And they were so, once I start talking about my life, and I've always created sound and movement games. It's just a way to loosen my own body up for stage, voice and body. But as I would move, they would watch me, because at first they'd just come into the gym and sit because they had to be there. But I was talking about my life. My daughter had just got married, and I was so excited at the possibility of being a grandma in another year or so. And they were just amazed that I would tell them so much about myself as I'm doing cartwheels, back bends, handstands. And I was 40, and I also told them this. And one of the women said, well, why are you telling us your business? Now, we as African Americans know that that's taboo. You don't tell people your business. But I said, well, you know, I'm interested in finding ways to create a bridge out of here. Can we create it with words? Can we create it with rhythm? Can we create it with sharing stories? And when this young woman, Regina Brown, who you'll meet in the For Colored, for Big Butt Girls, the For Colored Girls production, she said, well, then you're not the police. And I said, no, I'm an artist. And she said, what is that? And I've been attempting to answer that question ever since with my work with incarcerated women.
And at what point, then, did you make that bridge to acting? And is this acting that the incarcerated will actually participate in, I'm assuming?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And so at what point did you go from cartwheels and telling your business to having them involved?
They asked me, could they talk? As I got more in depth about my own story, about how, as a woman, we come into our sensuality, sexuality, looking for love in all the wrong places. And I talked about being a hippie girl back in the day, my own dance with dangerous men and drugs. And they said, well, can we talk? Everybody was biting at the bit to talk. And I said, as long as we can agree to respect the fact that what's said here stays here and that everybody's pain is equal, we can begin now. And people start. And I had to find ways. Thank God for Viola Spolin, one of my theater mentors. I had her book on hand, and I started creating situations based on exercises in that book that gave us room for every woman to speak. And they started talking.
Situations, meaning this is the premise? Or?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And setting up a structure. You know, let's begin with a story. Today is cold, and I arrived at the radio station. But just take it. You just have to take it. Don't no ands, no buts. Just go. And they were. It was wonderful. They thought I was a little whacked, but it was like they tried. And soon we got into the tears and the sadness and the people just gave it up. They just gave up their histories because nobody had ever asked them. Nobody had ever provided a place for them.
I have a sort of a irrelevant question, I suppose, but assuming that there's some kind of prison psychologist or psychiatrist, what would their response be to this?
You know what I found through the arts, through the creative process? I have been able to unearth much more stuff than the psychologist, the psychiatrist.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it has to do with, I think, they're con artists. They pretty much can figure out, well, you trying to get in my business. So I'm gonna say what I think you might want me to say, where I come in through the back door and I'm also willing to talk about me. Mm-hmm. It's not y'all versus mm-hmm. me, it's us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as women, what are we going to do about our families, about our children? How are we going to change our lives as women?
And you're just having to be on the outside.
Yes, exactly.
And what do you do if you have these stories that you say are going to stay there, they're going to be private, mm-hmm. but you are creating at the same time performance art that mm-hmm. becomes then public? How do you bridge the private with the sort of public sharing of this?
Well, that rule is much more for the people who are just gossips. There are people, they don't give anything. They sit there and they listen, they snicker. Oh, I've thrown people out of the group, you know, and I say, if I hear that you're out gossiping about this, you're out. And so again, to live outside the law, you must be honest. So you have all these people who come back and say, well, you know, she was on there telling people about what we said. So we got that. But then women want you to tell their story. So I would like dress the story up. When I made Big Butt Girls, I did it inside. They saw me giving birth to their lives, to their stories. Mm-hmm. And they would say, why would you want to make a piece about us, and who would want to hear about us? And at the same time, they were fascinated because they were engaged physically, verbally, visually, spiritually in constructing these characters that were women inside, you know, that mm-hmm. we all knew. Some of the women were in the room and they were tickled pink that I was attempting to recreate their voice so that it meant something. It had weight.
Gave dignity to their life. Dignity to their lives.
Yes. So are these mm-hmm. monologues that they're doing, or are they actually interacting with parts?
Well, the for Color Girls Project now, they've taken what I made a one-woman show out of, which was like physically morphing into different characters and speaking lines that I really heard. And the young women here at the university, they've like opened it up, and it has Greek chorus type stuff, and there are various voices under her directorship and vision.
Well, okay, Erica, why don't we talk about that? You're a student here at UW-Madison. What led you to start this group called For Colored Girls?
I came into college 3 years ago now, knowing that I was going to be an English secondary education major. I've always wanted to be a teacher. And I'm a First Wave student. First Wave is a scholarship program and learning community, as well as a hip-hop theater ensemble. And so coming from the Chicago Academy for the Arts, private arts school in Chicago, and having a theater background, having a heavy literature and performance background, I decided to double major in theater and English secondary ed. And I felt invisible at times, and I felt idle. And if anybody who knows me knows that I can't just sit and not do mm-hmm. anything. I learned a lot technically, like lighting and directing and just watching. But I didn't see the faces and stories of women of color regularly. I appreciate the Lorraine Hansberry Project, but that is ever so often. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to place myself. Like, I love First Wave, but it's not necessarily women-oriented. So I needed a space. And I'm all about creating space where there isn't any and bringing from margin to center, in the words of bell hooks. Mm-hmm. So the project became a way for me to deal with issues that I was dealing with, hence the namesake, which echoes Ntozake Shange's 1975 choreo poem for colored girls who've considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. Mm. I was also working at the Campus Women's Center my freshman and sophomore year. And yes, that was women-oriented, but I felt that the special needs and special oppression and special issues that women of color on this campus, which is a predominantly white university, are issues in this context and in a larger grand scheme of things of the world was still not being particularly tackled. And so it was like, well, how can I bring all of the things I've learned from all of these communities that I'm a part of and make a space that's not necessarily homogenous, because women of color are not homogenous. Mm-hmm. We're not the same. And I mean, there's a lot of different issues that we go through depending on your individual identity location, but how can I create a space where we can tackle those, and those are centered, and those are reverenced, and we are reverenced, and we feel important, and we're also running it? Because it's very different to be in a space where people are addressing you, but they're not people like you.
Well, as a director, as a playwright, as an actor, producer, How do you feel about this, I'll call it a kind of a racial countertypes in acting? In other words, black actors have parts in white plays. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're parts for black specifically. Sometimes they're kind of racial neutral. But for example, at UW, if you're doing kabuki, right, you're not going to have
right,
all Japanese actors. How do you feel about, I mean, a white person playing a black role or vice versa?
Well, I could tackle that one because I actually had this experience. And we just went through this experience at the theater department. So we just had a production of Derek Walcott's Tijon, which is set, it's Caribbean storytelling. And we had a challenge in terms of trying to find students of color who would be interested in being involved. One of the challenges was that it's not a popular title that's produced often. But then, quite frankly, as Erica mentioned, you know, there's this whole debate that happens, right? So do we do the black play or the play that features individuals of color to let those students know that there is a space here? And do we do that play first, or do we go out and say, hey, come, let's find a play that you all are interested in? So I would say the Academy, that challenge isn't unique to Wisconsin. I mean, that's an experience that I had as an undergraduate student. It's one of the reasons why I'm in the Academy, so I could help students like Erica out, because I was that student myself. But to the point, if the play structure, the theme, the issues that are being explored, if those are so much ingrained in the experience of what it means to be that quote-unquote other of the type that is not majority, not white, you can't fake that. You can't put something on it and call it something else. And so what I'm doing with Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is a play by August Wilson, one of the prominent African-American playwrights in the country, if not the prominent one, to try and cast a white person in a black role would be an insult to the telling of that story, because his task, his charge, his personal goal was to reflect a facet of the plethora, the wide stretch of the African-American experience. And sometimes talking about it in that terms implies there's this monolithic kind of way of living life as a black person during the 20th century.
Which is not
but
true,
he,
of course.
He captures so many facets and variables of what that identity is and the challenges that go along with that. So it depends on the show and it depends on the story if you can find a way to work around those challenges. And I would say we were successful in doing that with this production of Tijon, where the story, you know, we didn't have a black person in that, but we had the three brothers. One was Asian, one was white, and one was Latino. So we were conscious of the fact that we didn't have the body, we didn't have the image, the visual representation, but we were conscious of the fact that we had to have a way of telling that story that's still true to the roots. So you had a white guy, an Asian guy, and a Latino guy doing a Caribbean accent telling this story.
As brothers.
As brothers.
And that's, I mean, you know, that's acting.
That's, that is.
That's not the easy kind of typecasting. That's,
right.
That's counter to that.
So there's always a catch-22, and I would say it's an interesting conversation. And I think one of the challenges is when we talk about colorblind casting or, you know, anybody can play any role.
Right.
Well, in a utopic society, yeah, that's true. But the stories that are reflecting lived experiences of people who have been historically marginalized or kind of off on the periphery, to try to have someone else tell that story in some ways perpetuates the challenge that the story is trying to address by virtue of being told. And so we're constantly negotiating that balance between how to tell the story, who can tell the story, and where that agency lies, which is why I love what you talk about running it and then having it be about women of color and being in charge, because that's key. That's one of August Wilson's tenets. He felt very strongly about having black theater be for, by, and about black people.
We're going to talk more about performance art as a tool for encouraging transformation when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I've got 10 perfect fingers and 10 perfect toes.
Dark brown eyes, black kinky hair, and high cheekbones, just like my daddy. My mama used to tell me that growing up as a child, she used to say that every Sunday is part of her evening prayer. She used to say that no matter how bad things might look to you, always remember God made you perfect in his own way and can't nobody take that from you. 10 perfect fingers and 10 perfect toes. High cheekbones. Just like my daddy.
That's an excerpt from 10 Perfect, a lynching survivor story, as read by Patrick Sims, one of our guests today, along with Rodessa Jones, performance artist and founder of the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women, and Erica Dickerson, founder of the For Colored Girls Project. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. So, Patrick, tell us about your group, the Theater for Cultural and Social Awareness.
Yes, TCSA. I started this program in 2004 when I first came to the university, but I'd actually been doing this kind of work for, I'd say, the last 14 years as a graduate student. And what TCSA does in a nutshell is we give individuals an opportunity to have conversations about the hot button issues. So we talk about race relations, we talk about sexual orientation, we talk about gender, we talk about hostile work environment, we talk about religion, we talk about politics, we talk about everything. The convention is theater, whereby individuals who participate in this course, they have basically a safe space that's created where they can ask the quote-unquote dumb question. And we give them that opportunity to feel validated no matter what opinion or perspective they may have on an issue. But we then encourage them to challenge the ideas that are put forth in the space. And it's in that exchange of ideas and information where folks can feel free to learn and can speak more candidly about their thoughts and opinions on these potentially volatile issues. And after having that experience, we then transition to a point where they reflect inwardly about their own lived experiences and think about if they could do something over again, if they had an opportunity to redress an issue of social justice, their first consciousness of race or sexual orientation, whatever the issue may be, I give them that space to use those experiences, real life experiences, as material to create theater pieces that they then facilitate and have conversation with their peers. So it's a self-replicating cycle where the student first has the experience and they feel comfortable having dialogue. They then move into a point where they use the convention of theater to create and advance that dialogue, and then ultimately they develop skill sets that are connected to facilitating and leading those kinds of discussions in a way that is safe for all participants. And I think that's the thing that sets up, I would say, this kind of work that I do, that sets it apart from other work, that it's about having that safe space. And I think you mentioned that earlier, talking about what happens in a particular venue stays in that particular venue. And so what stories are shared, they're shared with the understanding that it is to shine, light, uplift, and unveil challenges that may revolve around whatever issue that they're exploring.
Is there any danger that, you know, the way sometimes people act as if just because you have a video camera, you can then become a great movie maker, mm-hmm. sort of skipping the whole process of the craft and the time it takes to become skilled at it. Is there any sense if you get people up and acting immediately that it implies that everybody can act, that we all have drama in our lives, and that any conversation then is elevated to the level of acting? Like, how do you sort of at the same time respect the craft of those who are really
That's a question that we struggle with in the academy, quite frankly. This kind of work was often bastardized, to be quite honest, when we talk about creating social issue theater.
Yeah.
The folk who had the skill set weren't always the folk who were doing this kind of theater. You had folk who understood the implication, the impact of the kind of work. So you had folks who were scientists, sociologists, but weren't trained actors. How I managed to sort of mitigate that dicey area is by having the students identify the issues that they're passionate about. So their passions drive the outcome. And if they're passionate about it, I can get them with enough rehearsal and time to what I call the ALP. The acceptable level of performance.
Mm-hmm.
Because the work isn't so much about creating this masterpiece that's going to have a life that, say, a Shakespearean text or even an August Wilson text, but it's really about the moment and the community that's created. And if you can have that community transformed and give them the skill sets to repeat that process, that's far more powerful and long-lasting and impactful than trying to challenge a student to have high aesthetics in the presentation.
Yes.
Now, it's not to say that aesthetics aren't important, because I have an advanced level course mm-hmm. where, you know, we enter into partnerships, collaborations, and there's a fee for what we offer. We don't give it away. It's not cheap, because I think that's another mm-hmm. misnomer that, oh, you'll do it for free. Mm-hmm. So we don't give this away. And so because that relationship is intact, there are expectations. And so I push students further to expand and work in those areas. But it's not something that drives the philosophy as much as it would be when I teach my normal acting class, where I'm training people to go out to be actors on the regional stage in the regional theater, although that's shifting as well.
So you're working even with these preliminary people, I'll call them, the ones who aren't necessarily actors by inclination. You're working with script. If I were
yes.
to come into your class, I'd say, okay, I have mm-hmm. these ideas, these thoughts, these experiences that I want to expound upon. You're going to say what? Write it down and we'll start with that and see what you've got?
Well, there's a process. And I would say, Rodessa, you have a process, I'm sure.
Yes, yes.
But so the actual development of the work is the last phase, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the funnest phase, right? The more interesting phase. But you got to sift through stuff. You got to sift through and get a sense of where people are really coming from in terms of their values, their ideas about these volatile issues. And you got to give them that space to own it, to push back, to challenge, to question. And you got to have the grace, if you will, to say we don't have the answers. And it's really not about providing answers as much as it is asking the right questions and giving them that opportunity to ask the right questions.
I think for the For Colored Girls project, we have some similarities with the mm-hmm. work that Patrick does. But for us, presentation is more for everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like this, see what kind of what we've been working on. But another reason I began the For Colored Girls project was to create sisterhood amongst women of color,
mm-hmm.
specifically on this campus.
Right.
Because if you're not in a scholarship program, or even if you are, sometimes you can get lost in being a part of such a large group. I mean, First Wave has 5 cohorts now.
Right.
I don't know everyone yet, having just returned from South Africa. But there needed to be an understanding of each other on this campus that I wanted to understand people better. I mean, at any campus, you're going to have gossiping and, mm-hmm. you know, preconceived thoughts about people. And so it was important to get women together who are actors, who aren't, but who all share this space. And certain issues that come with being in this space and being a woman of color, and get them in the same place for 3-4 months, 6 days a week,
mm-hmm.
for at least 5 hours a day, and learn each other, because I think we don't take enough time to learn each other. And so to see the sisterly bonds that have come out of being in a theater space together, and yeah, working on a play, but working on yourselves and working on your relationship with other women who might be just like you and you had no idea,
mm-hmm.
Has become a core part of our methodology. Like, it's really about developing and nurturing mm-hmm. these relationships. The directors of this year's production didn't even really talk last year. They knew each other's names, but they had never spoken two words. And now they're like traveling to Costa Rica on break together and directing a production. So it's these type of things that we aim to do. The production, you learning through it. And it is part of the activism, but the unconventional arts ensemble building and creating sisterly bonds is what really pushes the For Colored Girls project
mm-hmm.
forward. And so when we talk about what drama and theater and, you know, technicalities, you can know everything. I mean, I have a theater background, I have a literature background, whatever. I can write screenplays, know what they're supposed to look like. But if you're not feeling anything,
yes.
and if it's just art for the sake of art, then what are you doing? Like, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, what you're describing, the process is as important as the product.
Yes.
And I would say that's the thing for me, at least, that distinguishes what the three of us do, is that there's a very significant and important process that is healing, that is affirming, that is inspiring, that is then fueling the outcome in terms of what's finally presented in terms of a story that an audience, an external audience, can relate to and appreciate.
And I bet you really see that in the prison.
Yeah. I think it's the journey. I think we're talking about the journey to the stage. Working with incarcerated women, what interests me is helping them to find their voice, to say, this happened to me. You know, and then the icing on the cake is that if they can do it publicly. But I bring in actresses. The company is made up of actresses, mm-hmm. ex-offenders, social workers, midwives, so that these women are there to stand with the incarcerated woman. And if she cannot speak her truth, that she's there to witness somebody else shape it, sculpture it, and put it out there. But over the years, it's interesting how it grows. And the next year, everybody wants to tell their own story, mm-hmm. you know. And for me, I agree. It's really about creating community, you know, through women sharing their stories and realizing that we're more alike than unalike, you know. And yes, in prisons, it's very, very fervent. That people have so many stories, but valuing their stories, you know, valuing where you've been, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and also watching a woman put it on, you know, it's very, very interesting. I had a young woman write. She had been at Chico State in California, came home on Easter holiday, got involved with the boyfriend who had also dropped out of school, ended up. Prostitution, the whole thing, and experienced this incredible gang rape. And she was able to, with the help of my dramaturg, retell the story in such a way that it had light, darkness. It was even funny in places. She was able to describe the boys who were in this garage. And I was just like, well, on one level, my heart is breaking. And on another level, it's like, you know, to be able to tell this story. Mm-hmm. And two of the guys who had actually been a part of that came to the last show. We do public shows with the Medea Project. So two of those young men were sitting in the audience. Now, I am the general. That's who I am in the prison. There's no question about that. And it's about them understanding this is not Dream Girls. You know, this is not The Wiz. This is about our lives. Mm-hmm. And only you can tell the story. And also, tell your story so that somebody else won't tell your story. You be the first to tell your story. But it's about an empowerment and finding their voices. And you said something earlier about, you mentioned Ntozake Shange and how she's buoyed you. Toni Morrison buoyed me. When Toni Morrison, I read somewhere, Toni Morrison says, I write the kind of books that I want to read. Yeah. And I feel like I make the kind of theater that I want to see. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you do in the prison context, though, Rodesso, with people who have stage fright? I mean, do we assume that everybody, if they can get their story to be articulate, can get up in front of a group of people and tell them?
Well, I work from 4 to 6 months with the women inside because I have to do everything. I have to teach them simply how to stand up straight, you know, and some women can't write. I mean, but I have a team. And no, they, by the time they have crafted the story, either they can do it or they can't. And as I said, they want to. You know, they get to watch other women, other ex-inmates do their mm-hmm. stories. They want to do it. So no, mm-hmm. They want to do it. They're filled with joy about it.
I would chime in with that. More often than not, I mean, you do have those individuals who are like, I'll never do this. I can't do it. But more often than not, folks feel that somebody's actually going to pay attention to me.
Yes.
And
yes.
Once they feel that sense of empowerment, that someone's going to pay attention, that I can tell my story, mm. it's as easy as having a conversation with a long-lost friend. Mm-hmm. No matter how difficult the issue or the subject or content may be, it's that community that's been created that undergirds the process, that enables that individual to step forward into a light that perhaps they would never have done. And I see that all the time in the course I teach. Yeah. I have students who are, you know, flies on the wall. Like, you would know they were there, but by the end, they're like lions in performance.
Can't shut them up.
Right? And it's just like, where did you come from? Right?
Where's that voice?
So that's always affirming as an artist because you kind of feel like, you know, it's not for the sake of just entertainment, right?
Thank you. This
is life affirming. It is keeping us alive, literally. And so I think when we see challenges where arts are being cut in K-12, I'm just like, y'all don't know. You just don't know what you're doing, right?
Yeah, the power of the arts. Yeah. Do you worry at all about honesty? In other words, if we all kind of embellish stories sometimes. Mm-hmm. It we get more of an audience reaction if you add a few figures here and, you know, make the fish bigger. And, you know, if you have people who are telling their stories and getting reactions to it, how do you sort of – do you worry about the honesty angle of it at all? Or do you just figure there is a truth in however the story is told?
Well, you know, theater for incarcerated women, nobody had ever – in the last 20 years, nobody ever showed up at the county jail or at any of the prisons. Right now, I have an ongoing workshop at the women's prison just outside of Joburg in South Africa. Nobody's ever asked them what happened, you know, or what's the part you played in it, or what are we going to do now? And I really feel from my soul that they are telling the truth as much as they can. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's so profound, the space that we create, that I think anybody that comes in with other intentions is not going to last, you know. But I never worry about that. Right. I never worry about that.
And even so, I remember one of my poetry teachers from high school, Toni Asante Lightfoot, she used to say, there's a difference between fact and truth. Never let fact get in the way of your truth. And so remembering or not remembering exactly how things were doesn't really matter when we're seeking the heart of the story. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, while we produce other people's plays, we do share personal stories. And Rodessa, of course, her work is based on the stories of these women, but it's not... It's not about fact.
It's not about fact. Right. I know Rudyard Kipling said nobody knew what the truth was until someone told a story.
Well, my father used to say, never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Good story,
I would say from my vantage point, I mean, we obviously change the names to protect the innocent because the kinds of stories that are being shared are personal. And so we don't have to embellish much. I mean, the kinds of things that are brought to the forefront – you know, is it art imitating life or life imitating art? I mean, you could ask that question day in and day out, but I would say the orientation for the experience is so not about, ooh, let me get the attention or shift it. It's really about discovering who I am and where I fit in this dialogue on these issues. Where am I on, you know, what it means to be an African-American man, the male privilege I carry, and what it means to be married, to have that privilege. So where am I in that conversation? That's a very different point of entry than saying, ooh, here's a chance for me to kind of milk a moment and get discovered.
Well, as long as you use that word dialogue, Patrick, at what point would something like this involve dialogue? I mean, it's, so far we're talking about, you know, getting an individual's experience out and the individual presenting it to the audience. But at what point would this develop that next dimension into dialogue?
Well, I think this is where my work ends up being slightly different because I have the task to try and create a space for students like Erica to feel comfortable at a predominantly white institution. I also have to create that space for the white students to hear what Erica has to say, or students like Erica. I'm just using her because she's here as an example. And it's in that creating that space where if you're white, I don't want you to walk away feeling guilty, right? Because it's not about your guilt. It's about listening to what's happening in this moment, right? So challenging and pushing everyone to sort of step outside of their own comfort zones, that's a challenge. And so part of that is having that dialogue. And much like Rodessa, I'm always the first one in. So when I mess up, what my faux pas are, the things I get hung up on, I give other students, individuals, that freedom to own their shortcomings as well. And once folks are kind of owning it and we're all owning it in the same space together, now we're realizing, as you said, we're more alike than we are different.
Yes.
And that's a powerful, palpable moment that happens when you kind of go, wow, right? Every end of the semester, knock on wood, students come back and say, I had no idea what this class was going to be, but I'm so glad I took it. And I said, well, write that down.
Well, that is the power of drama, isn't it? In terms of if you're performing it for an audience, by implication, that's something you would say, whatever your experience has been, or something Erica would say, whatever hers have been, or Rodessa. It's going to resonate in some experience that I've had.
Mm-hmm. Because it's truthful. Yes. It's the truth that drives that. So it's not about showmanship or show and tell. It's a true vulnerable experience. And so if you're vulnerable in that way and honest, as you say, game knows game, right?
Yes, sir.
So
game
people
game.
People respond accordingly.
There's a production, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women, that's going to open on December 8th. And when we return in a moment, we'll talk about what you'll see if you join that performance. Back in a moment with more University of the Year.
Who are these women? And what? What are they to you? To you? To you? Oh, they wear my mother's face, my sister, my daughter. And if I'm to believe statistics, this could very well be my granddaughter. But I was raised in a family with a mother and a father. And my mother and father taught me that when problems become too great, you can always take it to God. Now the African in my American instructs me to take it to the ancestors. This is a spirit catcher for one Regina Brown. Regina Brown, daughter, sister, mama, lover, Regina Brown. Regina Brown, a sister so brilliant, so bright, she could have been running the world. Regina Brown, who was murdered after her second release from jail. Regina, daughter, sister, mama, lover. Regina Brown. Regina Brown, who was just another whore with a heart of gold. Regina, daughter, sister, mama. Regina Brown left a boy and a girl here howling on the ground. Left a boy and a girl here to make it in this hard luck place called the world. Regina, daughter, sister, mama, lover. Regina Brown. Regina Brown, who was one of my best drama students.
That's Redessa Jones reciting from her play, Big Butt Girls and Hard-Headed Women, which will be featured in free performances at the Play Circle at the UW, December 8th through the 11th. Redessa Jones is with us, and also, for the balance of this hour, Patrick Sims, the founder and director of the Theater for Cultural and Social Awareness, and Erica Dickerson, who is the founder of the For Colored Girls Project. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. And tell us about the play.
Oh, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women is a play that grew out of my early days of working in the San Francisco County jails, looking at women, creating a space for women to tell stories. And for me, because I was also a model, I was an artist's model, so I would spend my weekends in Palo Alto, California, posing as a part of something called the Ages of Women. I'd come back, and on Mondays, I'd be back in the jails looking at the ages of women in jails. And that was the Mama Pearl, who was the crone. That was Regina Brown, who was the matron. That was Doris, who was the virgin, the baby having babies. That was Lena, who was the screaming Volcry. And I was fascinated, and I started to capture their language. We weren't allowed to carry recorders inside the city jail, so I'd have to go home and write down what I heard. So what you're going to be seeing here is an ensemble made out of my solo show based on the language of women that I met at the San Francisco County Jail. But they're all, of the language is all true to these women, the rhythm, everything about it.
Just as well in a way that you weren't recording, because then that gets back to what we were saying about don't let the facts or the details get in the way. And in this case, you're sort of automatically forced to transcribe it to some something more like an art form.
Yes, but also the language. I love the language, and because we are on radio, we can't go
can't say
there.
It all.
but the language. I found that when you attempt to speak any other language, and I found that jail, that's a whole community in itself. You know, we use language now from jail, like the 411. the 911, you know, let's keep it real. This stuff grew out of this incarcerated population. So I was fascinated with how women talked, and if that's how they talked, how they thought. And I would go home and just like try to catch everything I thought I heard that day. And gradually I wanted to create the ages of women in an enclosed space, a captive space, if you will. So that's what Big But Reals turned out to be. And my father, I grew up with a father who was always saying, don't be so hard-headed. Sit your big butt down. You ain't grown.
That was my next question. I just wasn't sure how to get to it.
So my father. So I grew up hearing that my whole life. And here I was watching them walk around with all this swagger. And the first day that it dawned on me that I was going to make this play, there was a woman by the name of Deborah. Oh, she was about six. She was literally 6 feet tall. Oh, Concord grape-colored woman in chains going off to Chowchilla prison, and I'm sitting there waiting for my group to take them to the gym, and this woman walks by, and as she walks by, I hear in the distance Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, and this woman is walking, and she's like regal, and I'm my innocent little hippie self, I'm saying, take good care of yourself, okay? And she walks past me and she slowly turns and looks back at me. And she says, girl, don't worry about it. I got this. And she went walking off and her butt looked like an army behind her. It was like, boom, boom, the shoulders. And it was like, wow. And the deputies looked so dwarfed against her. And I thought, that's it, Big Butt Girls, Hard-Headed Women. And that was the title was the first thing. And my brother always said to name things is the intention to make things. So I wrote the title down. I said, that's the name of the play. And I started from there.
Kind of gets that sense of power, doesn't it? Now, before we get to the way it's going to be done here with multiple voices, when you perform it as a one-woman show, do you alter your voice for the different characters then?
Yeah, but more so it comes through the body first. The body will, but also I try to copy the women that I met in jail. Because I remember when I first started trying to build this piece, it was inside with the women. Instead of doing aerobics class, all of a sudden they were my laboratory, and they were allowed to handle me. I was studying the crew mime at the time as well, so I would let them come up and take my arm, take my head, and they would get to adjust me. They would get to move my body, and I realized that I was also teaching transformation to them. I was also teaching the idea that you can reinvent yourself back to acting and theater and art. But for them, it was like they were just fascinated I would be them. And at the same time, it was like, how do I quietly drive home the idea that this is more than creating a character? This is about you looking at your life. How do you want to change? We can reinvent ourselves. And that's one of the joys, the freedoms of, you know, art, I think, to be able to impose that or imply that to people.
Have you seen changes in any of these women's lives? What kind of changes?
I have several ex-offenders who are now members of my theater company. They're not back in jail. They have jobs. They're not doing drugs. They have jobs. They have their children, you know, and they claim the company. Early on, though, in the process, inside, a group of women would go on to prison or go home, and I would just get other inmates and bring them in and start the process all over. But there was a group of women who came to me and said, you can't do this. This is Ava's. This is Ava Company. And that was so moving. It was like, you know, this is Ava's show. And all of a sudden, I was saying, well, what can we do then? And they didn't know it, but they created orals. For any women coming in, they have to answer certain questions. Are you ready to tell the truth? I mean, it was, and I let them do this. And it's like, I could see that they were claiming this thing, that it was, and this is what they understood about what they had been through. So
this turns into a really, really tight-knit repertory company in a way.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Erica, as you take what was a one-woman show and then perform it here starting December 8th, what is it that we'll see if we come to see your performance?
There are five characters in Rodessa's show. So you will, instead of seeing one person embody all five, you'll see all five characters. We did not change the language or anything like that. It may be a slightly different from the printed text since we have had time with Rodessa this week, and we'll be able to see on her DVD of a performance that she did ways in which she changed it up a little than what is printed in the colored contradictions text of the play. But everything is still true to the play. The only thing that's different are probably transitions, music, and the fact that there are five bodies instead of one.
And I love the choral. I love that.
I was going to ask, what do you do with music in a play like that?
When I saw Rodessa's show last spring at Northwestern University, her partner Idris played the saxophone for all of the music.
Jazz musician, nice.
And he offered to do the music for our show, and we graciously declined only because the For Colored Girls Project has a set belief that the our stage is for women of color. And so I love Idris, and he is a bad sax player.
Yes, yes.
But for that reason, the group was like, we can't, because they wanted to stay true to that. So for music, we have a lot of different recorded. We're using some Nina Simone instrumentals because I love Nina. And it's very fitting for a lot of things. We're using some ballet instrumentals. A lot of the things are instrumentals. We did put some saxophone in there for As Time Goes By. So there's a sax solo. Everything is pre-recorded, but it's also tapered for the time allotted for each interlude and things like that. So you'll hear a mixture of different kinds of music.
But the whole thing, this whole concept of women only, if you get back to the genesis of it, Rodessa, it really couldn't have happened in any other situation, could another? You have to have these women without men in order to get this effect, in order to really get them to tell their stories.
Exactly. Women change in the company of men. Then you do have you can have untruths or the embellishment or the kind of competitive edge when there are men. I did Big Butt Girls for men, one of the first shows I did. They recognized the women, and they were very respectful, and they encouraged me to keep telling the truth, they said. They keep doing it, sister. And then I did my first show with the Medea Project at the county jail, and they brought in men to see the women perform, and the women just fell apart. It was like they got to jostling each other. They got to arguing. They were very nervous. They were worried about what they looked like. I had to stop the show to start the show. And the men would say, come on, y'all. Come on now. Just do your show. Do your thing. It was very, very interesting that they were feeling how important it was. And I was so grateful for that because they helped to drive the show by saying, what are y'all doing? You know, and the women were so busy, worried about what they were thinking. The guys are like, we just want the next action to happen. Yeah, so.
So they become self-conscious in the company of men.
Yeah.
Unless they somehow overcome that at showtime.
Yeah, yeah. Well, by the time they got, and I never leave them alone. When the Medea Project performs, I have a chair that's designed. I sit out front, and I drive the show like a conductor, you know. Because I know that their families out there. We always play for full houses. So you have like these people who've been working in a jail, and all of a sudden they come into a public theater and there are people hanging from the rafters. And it's like, and Rodessa's job is to focus. Where we at? Where we at? And they love it. I didn't know I was going to do it. But a technical director said, well, this is your chair. Because all during rehearsal, he had saw me. When we moved into the theater, he said, well, this is your chair, Miss Jones. And I said, for what? He goes, well, you're going to be sitting here, right? I guess I'm in this show too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're part of it. Listening to the three of you talk, I realize how many places would profit from a theater group like what you've each started. You know, you can think of all the places around this country that people have stories, have a need to tell them, and have a need to kind of explore transformation.
Yes.
So, thanks to all three of you for sharing your stories and for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our guests this hour have been Rodessa Jones, performance artist and the founder of the Medea Project, Patrick Sims, UW professor of theater, founder of the Theater for Cultural and Social Awareness, and Erica Dickerson, founder of the student-run For Colored Girls Project at the UW-Madison.